Good morning, everyone. We're going to get ready to start our program this morning. Thank you all for being here. I'm Jim Lakely. I'm the Communications Director at the Heartland Institute, and I want to welcome you to Chicago and the 7th International Conference on Climate Change that Heartland has hosted, otherwise known as Occupy Common Sense on the Climate. I hope you all got a chance to see the sights if you've come in early, especially the zoo that's walking through the streets of Chicago. Quite the scene, not a thing that happens every year. But again, welcome. We're very excited to have you all here and to host this conference again, yes, for the 7th time. But to really start off the program, my job was to get you to look up here. And now it is time for our president, Joseph Bast, to talk a little bit about the Heartland Institute and the purpose of this conference. And with that, Joe Bast.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much for joining us. As Jim mentioned, there are protesters outside this building, and there's probably a couple of protesters in this room. Over the course of the next 2.5 days, I fully expect that there will be at least a few people trying to disrupt the presentations. It's important that you not try to tackle these people or hit these people. You're not supposed to touch them. We have security. Security is kind of focused on protecting the speakers, though. So if there's somebody at your table who is trying to disrupt the activities, feel free to point them out to the security guards, and you'll see them standing in the front of the room and at the back of the room, and make sure that our event goes without problems. If there is a disruption, one of the coolest things that I've seen, which I saw at CPAC, was the audience started to chant, "Get a job, get a job." And it drowned out the protesters. There it is. Okay, we are here today to look under the hood of a major social and political movement, to ask some tough questions about an issue that increasing numbers of people, especially in the mainstream media, think is so politically incorrect that you get punished for even asking the questions. Environmental groups that have budgets of hundreds of millions of dollars have staked out a position on this. Whole industries, wind and solar, are based on public fear of global warming. And the mainstream media has pretty much given up its role as an independent reporter on these things and has become an advocate and is simply taking sides in what should be a very exciting debate. As Holman Jenkins, I can't see the screen, so I'm going to hope that that they're keeping up with me. Nick, give me one second. Nikki? Nikki is waving her hands, and is there somebody that I can look at who can move the Keeley in the back? Okay, thank you, Keeley. Holman Jenkins in the Wall Street Journal recently wrote, "The production of content-free outrage for angry ignoramuses is a vertically integrated industry." And manufactured outrage is a lot of what we're seeing in the media these days. I hope you can join me in thanking the speakers. We have 51 scientists, economists, and policy analysts who are going to be speaking at this conference. Only two speakers withdrew as a result of all the controversy and the media campaigning against us. After they withdrew, 12 other speakers came forward and offered to speak for free. So we added three. Yeah. So we ended up adding three concurrent sessions just to accommodate all the additional speakers. We invited more than 30 scientists from what's called the warmest crowd or the alarmist crowd, and unfortunately none of them agreed to speak. Nikki, can you move to the next slide, please? The one after that. There we go. We invited Professor Carrie Norgaard. Some of you recognize her. She says that all global warming skeptics are insane, essentially, and racists. But she declined to speak at this event. I'd also like to thank all of the co-sponsors. They're listed in the program. We have 60 co-sponsors for this event. There we go. And that's a new record for one of these conferences. And we're absolutely delighted that so many groups are willing to stand up and be with us. I understand that there are 67 bloggers and new media people who are registered to cover this event. Very special welcome to all the bloggers who are in the room. There's also a few fake reporters in the room from phony media outlets. I won't mention any names because that would be impolite. But they're not here to interview you. They're not here to report the truth about what you think or what's going on at this conference. And you're not under any obligation to answer any of their questions. Please don't hit them. Please don't kick them. But recognize that they're in the room. I'd also like to thank all of the donors and the Heartland staff who made this event possible. Before February 14th, the Heartland Institute had 1,600 current donors. Today, we have 2,500 current donors. And we're getting new donors at the pace of 200 a week. It was a kind of kick in the seat for me and for the Heartland Institute to diversify our funding base, reach out to people who have always been longtime supporters but not giving as much as they could. And they've all responded just extremely positively and generously. So we greatly appreciate that. I also want to thank the Heartland staff for putting this event together in record time. We made a late decision once again to hold this event, and so they managed to pull this together in just 3 months. I think many of you have met James Taylor. James recruited all the speakers. Antoinette Blackaneri. Is Antoinette in the room by any chance? Yes, there she is at the back door. Antoinette recruited all of the co-sponsors, did a fantastic job. Jim Lakely, who just introduced me, oversaw all the marketing for the event. Nikki Comerford, once again, handled all of the logistics. Nikki is right there. And Zawiya McElrath, my assistant, managed the registration. And there's a bunch of other Heartland staff who pitched in every day for the last 3 months in order to make this thing successful. I would also like to thank Al Gore and 350.org for helping us promote this event. Without them, the mainstream media would have done a complete censorship or blackout on this event the way they've done the last two events. But Al Gore, God bless him, is taking out billboards, helping us promote the event. I think it's really significant that over the course of the last 4 months, we have gone from where the left's strategy was to ignore us, say nothing about us, refuse to debate, refuse to acknowledge our existence, to running billboards on freeways comparing us to all of the National Academies of Science in the world. I mean, that's, I think, a dramatic change in their side's tactics, and I think it's only going to work out really well for us. And finally, a lot of people have asked me to say a few things about Fakegate, and I have to say legal counsel says we shouldn't say anything about this because it messes up the litigation. But because Peter Glick's crimes affected quite a few people who are speakers and who are attending this conference, I feel duty-bound to say at least a few things about it. As those of you who haven't been following it should know, on February 14th, Peter Glick, the president of the Pacific Institute, released confidential corporate documents that he stole from the Heartland Institute. And he posted them online and sent them, or actually sent them to some allies who then posted them online, along with a fake document that purported to be the Heartland Institute's strategy on global warming. Left-wing websites gave it a lot of play. Think Progress headlined its article. If you could go to the next slide, please. Whoops. There's our Fakegate t-shirt, by the way. There are free T-shirts in the exhibit area, so if you'd like a T-shirt, please help yourself. Can you go to the next slide, please? There we go. So Think Progress headlined its article, Heartland Documents Reveal Fringe Denial Group Plans to Pursue Coke Money, Dupe Children, and Ruin Their Future. The Huffington Post also reported on it more succinctly. They said, they're coming for your kids. The result of this negative publicity was just an avalanche of emails and phone calls and tweets and stuff from the left pretending to be just outraged by what we were up to. Here's one of the more tame ones, if you can switch to it. You're just a bunch of right-wing lying scum, greedy hack job a-holes. Actually, I think that ran in The Guardian rather than as an email, but maybe not. Anyway, so we lawyered up. We've got a top-tier set of attorneys. They've done extensive research on what Peter Glick did and what our legal remedies are. They made a presentation to the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Chicago, which we thought was well-received. The U.S. Attorney's Office is considering whether or not to press charges against Peter Glick and his co-conspirators. We told the U.S. Attorney's Office that we would hold off filing a civil suit against Glick and others so as not to interfere with their investigation. For more information, there's a document called Background on Fakegate and the Heartland Institute on the literature table out the door and to the right next to the Fakegate t-shirts. I hope you'll take a look at that, and I think it'll answer any questions that you might have. Okay. And now it's my privilege to introduce James Taylor. He's a Heartland Research Fellow. He's the managing editor of Environment and Climate News. He's a columnist for Forbes.com, and he's the person most responsible for making this conference possible by recruiting all of the speakers. Please welcome James Taylor.
All right, well, first of all, Joe, I wish you would have told me that you were fearing for security here, because I have two teenage daughters who are perfectly capable of ushering in World War III at a moment's notice, so I could have brought them here to sic on anybody who disrupts this room. Believe me, they would be very, very effective. Now, for everyone in the room here, thank you so much for coming here to Chicago, making your way through the gauntlet of police, riot troops, etc., to make it here to the Hilton for this conference. Driving in from the airport yesterday, let's see, making it through the Chicago PD, all the roads that were blocked off, the state police. The closer and closer I got here, I saw more of the troops now wearing SWAT gear, riot gear, barricades. Finally made it through about, 30 or 40 cops at the front door, of course, all in the helmets and the shields. Got up to my room, looked out the window, surveyed all the troops in full riot gear, and thought to myself, I could swear Moncton must be here. Turns out it was just Murano over there. If it was Moncton, they would have stormed the building by now. But, Mark, you've inspired quite a presence here. Also, you may notice some of the folks, the speakers here that are lined up on the agenda and some of the attendees, you may notice they're not here this morning. And that just tells us that we have quite the, my daughters might say the geek conference, but I'm going to be more professional and say the scientific conference, because they're out on the West Coast watching the annular eclipse. And, of course, they said, well, there's no way that I'm going to be speaking on Monday. If you can put me on Tuesday or Wednesday, because I'm not missing that eclipse for anything. Well, I made it a point to say, okay, I can work around that. Just make sure that you get video of that eclipse. Because number one, James Hansen 10 years from now will have, quote, adjusted the eclipse out of the record books entirely. Michael Mann at the state Penn, I mean Penn State, sorry, Mike. Michael Mann at Penn State will have sued anyone that even jokes about the eclipse. And Gavin Schmidt for the next 6 months will say that this recent rash of eclipse sightings proves we're facing a global warming apocalypse. And then for the next 6 years after that, we'll say the fact that we haven't seen a rash of eclipses over the past 6 years proves we're facing a global warming apocalypse. So we definitely want to get that on video. So if they're out there watching, make sure you do get video. I want to see it. Joe mentioned earlier that we had invited many warmists to speak here. And all levity aside, we have in the past, we've made it a point to invite dozens of people who believe we're facing a global warming crisis to come here and speak. And this year, I personally invited over 50. I believe the final number was 57. I invited them long before the controversy when the media tried to shut us down here. And regardless, not a single one agreed to come here and speak. Not a single one out of 57, joining the dozens from previous years. And it just goes to show who is interested in debate, who feels the science is on their side, who doesn't mind stepping up to the podium and having that discussion. If the 57 warmest who I invited had agreed to speak, if even half of them had agreed to speak, they would have had equal numbers here at the conference. If anything more than half, if any number more than half would have agreed to speak, they would have had a clear majority, and we were willing to give it to them. But once again, as has been the case for years, they refused to show up. Now, where have they gone? I mean, as best as I can tell, they're on the lam in the Climate Witness Protection Program. And you would think that Joe Bast and I are Tony Soprano and Silvio Dante, given the fact that they're in such deep hiding. But because they weren't here, because they decided not to show up, we did invite some more speakers, as Joe mentioned, and I am happy to announce that we will have, I just confirmed yesterday afternoon, one final speaker that we will have tomorrow at lunch. This, quote, mystery speaker, I won't reveal his name. You will certainly want to be here for tomorrow's lunch. So we are filling the program. We gave the warmest their opportunity, but I think you're going to like our mystery speaker and maybe be glad they didn't show up after all. And the fact is, the reason why they don't show up is the debate indeed is over. The debate has been over since 2007 when Richard Lindzen and company very famously mopped the floor with Gavin Schmidt and company in the nationally broadcast Intelligence Squared debate. For those of you that aren't familiar with it, they hosted a debate in New York City, prestigious Intelligence Squared Society. Before the debate, they surveyed the audience. They asked whether we're facing a global warming crisis. Before the debate, by a 2-to-1 margin, the audience believed we are indeed facing a global warming crisis. After the debate, they surveyed the audience again, and this time, the audience voted, cast their votes, and said that we are not facing a global warming crisis. It has been that moment. There have been many debates beforehand, but since that debate, it is virtually impossible to get a warmist to come on stage, whether it's a debate, whether it's dueling presentations, whether it's just a simple discussion where we can share ideas, they won't do it. We tried our best at this conference. You see the results. Now, by contrast, we here at the Heartland Institute, here at the 7th International Conference on Climate Change, we welcome debate. We welcome the free exchange of ideas. There is no orthodoxy regarding the climate question. Just last night, I had the pleasure of sitting at a table where several of the scientists were debating back and forth. Joe Bastardi and Dennis Avery in particular were debating how much the sun is influencing climate, how much the oceans are, clouds, etc. And it really spoke to the strength of the skeptic viewpoint. Because rather than finding one particular very narrowly defined solution, I guess not solution, but causation, for the warming we've had, and then sticking to it. And if we have to hide the decline, if we have to destroy documents, if we have to pressure the editors of peer-reviewed publications not to let the other side in. Rather than doing that, we have folks at the table debating very sharply. And it was a very sharp debate. But it was a debate that was sharp, and at the same time, it was congenial. It was professional. There was room for differences of opinion, and there always has been within the skeptical movement. And I think that's something that we should applaud, certainly when we talk about where the science really resides, with the alarmists or with those who question the global warming crisis that's been asserted. That being said, I mentioned Joe Bastardi, and with that I'll segue into introducing this morning's keynote speaker. Joe Bastardi is here. Well, before I read his credentials, he's here to redeem Penn State University and clean up the mess for Michael Mann. So thank you, Joe. If there are any other Penn State graduates in the room, I'm sure that they're very appreciative of your efforts to do so. Joe Bastardi is the co-chief forecaster at Weatherbell Analytics. His reputation for making bold and accurate forecasts has landed him on major television programs, including Fox News Live, The O'Reilly Factor, The Colbert Report, CBS's The Early Morning Show, IMUS in the Morning, and many others. He's the only known meteorologist to have lettered in Division I wrestling, so I guess, Joe, you can be our security as well. Thank you very much. And it's a skill that he notes he has needed to use given the attacks on him in the climate fight. So, ladies and gentlemen, Joe Bastardi.
Well, let's see. I'm going to have to be glancing off. They told me I got to look at the camera. I don't know why a camera would want to look at me anyway. But what I'm going to do here is a little bit different from some of the things you may be acquainted with. For instance, Dr. Mann, who I've never really had that big a problem with, honest, you know, I don't hide the decline. What I'm going to do is show you what I'm doing now before it's even out there, and then you guys can make a decision on whether I'm right or not. That's what we do in the private sector. In fact, I come from the private sector. It's almost like, remember that song by Springsteen, The River, where he goes, I come from down in the valley, like, you know, or Johnny Cash song, well, I come from the private sector, and nowadays that's like, you know, coming from Folsom Prison or something, the way things have been going. But in any case, let me, I have to cue myself off this. I always write PowerPoints for me, and then I figure, well, if the audience wants to come along, they can watch too, and that's the way I do things. Now, times have changed. I want you to look at this this chart here. Actually, it's four different charts, all right? And what we have here is we have CO2 continuing to move up, yet the global temperature apparently has leveled off. I say apparently because when they get through readjusting temperatures before the satellite era, we'll find that it was actually skyrocketing higher than the CO2. In the last 3 years, there's been a jagged downward trend since the PDO flipped to cold. Let's see what else. Oh, we have Joe DeLeo's little interesting chart there that shows that the correlation between the oceans and the U.S. temperature is almost dead on. And then we see the solar cycle correlation. Dennis and I last night were not really arguing. What we were debating was how much effect the sun may actually have. And over the past several years since this solar cycle has gone into the tank, I've said, that's pretty interesting that some of these folks years ago actually said that this was going to happen with this solar cycle. But in any case, you could see it seems that the correlation might be a little bit greater with the oceans than the sun. Now, I'm an ocean man myself. Okay, I believe that the heat capacity of the ocean generally rules the roost, and the outside radiation from the sun has a longer-term effect, obviously, up and down to some extent. But I don't believe CO2 has anything to do with the weather. I call CO2 plant food. And that's what I really believe it is. Now, if we go to the next chart here, there's the forecast versus reality here. You could see where the IPCC was with their forecast. And now, if I told you a foot of snow was going to be falling in Chicago by 3 o'clock this afternoon and it happened to be 90 degrees and sunny at noontime, you might doubt that forecast. Now, if someone keeps telling me the temperature is going to keep going up, but it's actually leveled off and started going down, and I also see the disconnect with the CO2, I would think that if you were rational, you would think, maybe there is a degree of doubt here. So if we move to the next slide, a logic question in 1972 on this matter would have said, let me get out here. But you guys can read what it says, right? That it looks like CO2 is not involved here, right? But now if you take that question today, if we move to the next chart, that same question today would say that you can't trust the CO2. That obviously what's going on is CO2 is in control, the data is fabricated, of course George Bush is responsible for it, and everything that doesn't show CO2 is actually wrong. So things have changed around today. In other words, a lot of the things that I'm observing today, whoa, what do we have here? You know what's great about this stuff, it's like karaoke, you know.
That wasn't my stomach rumbling. Yeah, I'm going to put that right in my pocket. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. This is good because I can get down here and look at what, oh man, look at what I'm doing over here. So, oh, I clicker. Now, see, they take care of everything, right? The problem is I never know how to use these things until I get going here. Now, let the green arrow, oh, well, but the fight here is not for the faint of heart. Now, I've discovered that. There's a guy that, my wrestling coach at Penn State was a guy named Bill Cole. Three-time All-American, never scored a punt in college, three-time national champ, one of the first men on the beach in Normandy, one of my heroes. His son is one tough son of a gun, coaches at Cornell, won the national title. He says to me one day, aren't you afraid? I go, afraid of what? I never even thought about it. He goes, well, all these people will be coming after you and everything else. Aren't you afraid? And I go, yeah, I never really thought of it that way because when you're looking at truth, you generally just focus on the truth rather than all the other stuff that's going wrong. Now, I think that what a big problem is something that came out of Cornell called the Dunning-Kruger effect. Has anybody ever heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect? Yes, you have. Okay, well, Dunning-Kruger is arrogance and confidence from ignorance. In other words, you simply ignore everything anybody else has said and only focus on what you believe. And so you don't have anything challenge you. Now, I was brought up a very different way. For instance, being the son of an Italian guy from Providence, Rhode Island, when Rocky Marciano was the heavyweight champ, every Italian guy my dad's age thought their kid was the next Rocky Marciano. Consequently, my dad said, you have to overcome challenges, you have to do this, you have to do that. So I only get confident when I've been in a fight over something and have convinced myself that I can overcome something in front of me, as opposed to just ignore it, it'll go away, and it doesn't have anything to do with reality. So I think that some of the things that are going on here, and I notice some of the statements being made, for instance, Mr. McKibben, Ms. Cullen, or whatever, and Dr. Mann, there are statements about Irene, right? The heavy rains are from global warming. They either don't know what happens with hurricanes up the eastern seaboard, especially in the 30s through 50s, when the AMO was warm before, or they do know and they're simply lying about it. It's one or the other. Because you see a hurricane like Irene and everybody says, oh, it's a sign of global warming. I'm sitting there going, it fell apart for goodness sakes. You have no idea what happened before. So either they're ignorant of the facts before and they don't bother looking, or they do know the facts and they don't want you to know. But a possible question based on the charts, wait, I just went backwards instead of forwards here. Now, this is something interesting here. We see two distinct curves up in the Arctic temperatures and one down, right? You see these years over here. There were two times when the Arctic warmed up. It's been warming up recently, and one down. I'm going to explain that a little bit later. Hint, it has to do with the ocean temperatures there, all right? Now, given that Bill Gray is right again, we could all go home now. What I mean, 6 years ago I was in here, and Dr. Gray, he's sitting right over there, said, the global temperature is going to start falling as soon as the PDO starts flipping into cold, and the AMO will follow it. And he had this chart up there, and guess what? He's right, okay? So I just wanted to acknowledge Dr. Gray. Because he is right. He, in the 70s, he was telling us that it was going to warm up and there'd be hurricanes all over the place, and we were freezing to death at that time. I forget if you were at Millersville or Penn State. I saw you over there. I was like crying because I was a snow lover. I said, oh, that's it. Yeah. But in any case, I want to thank the IPCC because what I'm going to show you here is a couple forecasting techniques I've pulled out over the past years. When I went in to debunk the 400 to 200 millibar warming, I noticed an interesting correlation with hurricanes and tornadic activity. And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to present it out in front of you, and then you guys and ladies can all watch it over the coming years to see whether I'm actually accurate or not about it. And again, I'm going to show you something that is not researched. I don't have peer review or anything else like that. I'm putting it out there to be tested, so you folks are seeing this. The bottom 10 ace years, that's accumulated cyclonic energy in the tropics. Look at the 400 millibar level here in March. Over the tropics, it's very, very cold. You see that deep blue over the tropics right there? You see a signal of warm over cold in the tropical Atlantic Ocean in March, all right, at 400 millibars. If we look at the top 10 ace years, we see the opposite signal in March. It's cold in the northern and central Atlantic, warm off Africa, warm in the southwest Atlantic. Right in the two areas, you look for maximum ventilation. So you get the tropical waves coming off Africa. They bust through what we call the TUT, the tropical upper tropospheric trough, and they try to develop in the southwest Atlantic. Now remember, this is March. So what I've put together here is showing you, and again, this comes off the IPCC saying it's warming up at that level. So I got to go in there and look at, see what they're doing. Then I started using other techniques to say, hey, how can I come up with a forecast technique from this? Now, what is fascinating was the two years that we had a hyper ace index, a lot of hurricane activity during the El Niños, 1969 and 2004, look at how warm it was at that 400 millibar level in March. It actually trumped the El Niño in those years. So we're going to be testing this over the years. As I go forward, it'll be another forecasting technique I'm using. But it came off the climate fight. If I wasn't into the climate fight, I wouldn't be looking at this particular level. Now, this year, this is what we look like in March. So my forecast is for below normal ACE. The reason why I'm no longer using numbers is I don't know what they're going to name and when they're going to name it. They may name something heading for Ireland, for all I know. So they get all these different numbers, and the numbers are getting trumped up in some places and not in the other. But you have a warm over cold signal, and the forecast I put out WeatherBell this year was for a lower ACE index, but we have to watch out for smaller storms developing in close to the United States coastline. You know, like in 76, you had Belle develop in the Bahamas and come up, or Bob in 91. And sometimes those are the worst because they develop within a day or two of landfall, and all of a sudden someone's thinking, hey, the weather's great, and then bang, something's in someone's backyard. So you guys are seeing this. We'll see how the forecast turns out. Now, this is even as or more interesting. Looking at the global 400 millibar temperature and its trend off the AMSU site, you know, Dr. Spencer's site, every time the 400 millibar temperature falls from the year before globally, tornado activity goes up. Every time it rises, it goes down. So even though we had that huge March outbreak this year, I said tornado activity is going to go into the tank. And sure enough, if you look at how much tornadic activity there's been, we had the one mid-April outbreak, and it's been very, very quiet. Unfortunately, the 400 millibar temperatures over the last week have begun to fall. And when I saw that at the beginning of last week, I said, look out, Memorial Day week. There's liable to be a big outbreak of tornadoes in the Midwest and the Central Plains this week. But I want to show you this right here. They're the tornado totals, and you can see how we ramped up quickly, and we've leveled off. Okay, the black line is this year. Now, 2005 is in yellow. 6 is in the pinkish color there. There was an increase from 2005 to 2006. 6 to 7, a decrease. 7 to 8, the temperature fell at 400, up go the tornado totals. 8 to 9, a decrease. If it rose and we had less tornado activity. 9 to 10, a decrease. Remember 2010, there was hardly anything. Big drop, the biggest drop that I've seen in the AMSU in 1 year occurred from 10 to 11. After the La Nina came on, there was a tremendous drop in mid and upper level temperatures. And of course, the warmingistas say, oh, that's because it's global warming's causing the tornadoes. Yet I was seeing 400 millibar, 500 millibar troughs that were coming across that were absolutely mind-boggling last year, and they were kicking off tornadoes. 10 versus 11, a massive increase in the tornadic activity. 11 versus this year, the 400 millibar temperature came up, and guess what? Down come the tornado totals. So this all came off researching what the IPCC was saying. All I'm saying to you is there's value in being a meteorologist and being involved in the climate fight, especially since, as my dad said, you don't know where you're going unless you know where you've been. All right, and that is exactly true with the weather. A good meteorologist knows his climatology. When I used to work at my former company, the guys would try to play this game and say, okay, 1951, storm hits North Carolina, what was its name? And I'd be able to actually none of them hit North Carolina. Abel, the first storm in 51, stayed out at sea. Category 3 hurricane in the month of May, believe it or not. But what's interesting is you have to know what the weather's been doing to understand where it's going. And these folks that keep saying, oh, well, you're not a climatologist. When I was at Penn State in the 70s, you know what we used to call climatologists? Meteorologists that can't forecast the weather. Now, I'm only kidding. Now, come on. Hey, lighten up, all right? No, you need to know that. You need to know that. When I hear these people talking, well, so-and-so's a climatologist. I say, well, why are they making the statements they make? It's like they're oblivious to what went on. You know, Des Moines, Iowa has not busted a record high temperature in the month of July since 1955. That's how 29 records set between 29 and 55 because it was so darn hot. If we were training satellites on the United States or the globe in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, last time we had the PDO and AMO warm together, it would have blown away this particular period. I'm amazed that we haven't had more hurricanes up the East Coast. In fact, I'm in danger of busting here. I said New England was going to get two major hurricanes by 2015, and obviously with the falling apart of Irene, that didn't happen. Now, the biggest questions for me right now is, will I thank the IPCC when I get my Nobel, and can I play myself in the movie? Now to get into the other part here, to start all this off and where I want to go with this ACE index and some of the theories I'm putting out here and with the global sea ice, I think this says it all. the heat capacity of the ocean is so much greater than the atmosphere that comparing CO2, saying CO2 is driving the entire system, is like blaming a hangnail for obesity, okay? I don't think it jives. I'm just going to make this point here. So what we've got here, CO2 is point, and I've become over the years, I guess I'm one of these guys that's called a slayer. I don't believe it has a darn thing to do with it. And maybe it's because I'm stupid and I can't get my hands around the idea that it's so very, very minute. I'm trying to figure out how it has anything to do with things, right? But, yes. There's another zero in there. Okay, well, I there's so many zeros in there. But let's just go on here because this is minutely small. Garrett, you should have warned me about that if I made a mistake. That's my son, Garrett. He usually corrects everything. In fact, everybody in my family corrects me. That's about what's happened. In any given crowd, I'm the dumbest person there and the worst athlete, and that includes my family. Okay, man's contribution, 3 to 5%. Those are Department of Energy figures. Department of Energy. Okay, I'm talking to the media over there. That's not me making it up, okay? That's what the Department of Energy says. So it's not the Cato Institute, not YMCA or Rum DMC or anybody like that. It's using 5%, I'm going to use the top level, 5%. That means man puts in 0.002. I guess there should be another zero in there. Termites put in 2.5 times the amount of man. Now, here's what's great. I talked to Greg Gutfield over at Fox. He's on the 5. So I put that fact to him. He says, well, climate progress says it's a different type of CO2. I said, Greg, what? I didn't understand. Like, I'm going to be a different type of civilian. Yeah, again, I'm going to assume that I'm pretty dumb about this. 5 minutes? Oh, man. Okay, so we're to believe the greenhouse gases, 1/400th of the greenhouse gases that we have put in 0.002 is something that has of 1/1000th of the heat capacity of the ocean is ruining the planet, all right? I went the wrong way. This is, see, I'm panicking over here. Wait, there's more. U.S. on its worst day puts in 20%, meaning we've contributed a bunch of zeros, point a bunch of zeros and four. The yearly base is 1.5 parts per million. You get the idea how small this is. So here's the moral of the story. The PDO and AMO on the U.S., and this is courtesy of Brian Bledsoe, you could see there is a temperature relationship here. This is the case for the ACE, the Accumulated Cyclonic Index. You see the PDO and AMO going up and down. The more recent PDO, we continue to go into the colder phase. The AMO is still in its warmer phase, should be there 5 to 10 more years, and then start to back down. Now, as the Earth began to warm, as the PDO and AMO, okay, both went to positive, up comes the ACE Index. Until an equilibrium is reached, and the crucial assumption, you see the ocean heat content, how high this is. I didn't realize there's only 5 minutes here. The crucial assumptions are, this is from my dad, that tropical cyclones are essential in the redistribution of energy. That was drilled into me from when I was 5 years old. I didn't hear the three little bears. I heard that. Tropical cyclones take energy out of the tropics and redistribute it. So what happens is if the energy is already redistributed, if it's warmed in the northern hemisphere, especially up across the Arctic areas, what's the use of having the tropical cyclones? So when you have the warm PDO and then the cold PDO, what happens is that energy from the tropical cyclones gets redistributed and adds heat to the atmosphere. The initial warming's in the tropics. What happens? Up comes the hurricane activity, the initial warming during the hurricane activity. The ACE turns up because of the spike of the energy in the tropics. But once that has happened, there's an equilibrium. Ever sit in a sauna? You turn the sauna on, it heats up until there's no more heat to be given, and then the temperature stays the same. So there's no more increase in energy. Now, look at the 400 millibar from 72 to 91. Very, very cold in the north and neutral in the south. It's flipped around. It's flipped around completely. So what's happened is the tropics have accomplished their mission. The warm PDO, the warm AMO has accomplished its mission. Now that we're there, we're going to have to go back the other way. And you know what is dangerous here is at that level at 400 millibars, when you that's up in the stratosphere during the Arctic winter. What does that mean? More blocking. When you turn down the PDO and turn down the AMO, you're turning down the thermostat in the atmosphere. The first place it's going to cool is the mid-levels. Then the lower levels are going to cool next. What happens if you have excess blocking? You're starting to see the result. You're starting to see the flip around beginning to occur. So again, the implication, since the winter troposphere, a tropopause is lower than 400 millibars, this means enhanced blocking. The switch of the PDO AMO means cooling starting over the mid-latitudes first. Enhanced blocking, cooling threatens more severe winters as turnaround progresses. I love the way this year people forgot how cold it was the last two winters in the United States. Those of us who actually think in global terms understand how bad this winter was in the Northern Hemisphere. The Northern Hemisphere land masses were very, very cold. Now, the surface in 72 to 2011, of course, these are readjusted temperatures, too. And you see the switch in the surface. Everybody goes, whoa, the Arctic's warming. But let's remember that if you drop a temperature 1 degree where there's an 80-degree wet bulb, I believe that has 100 times the energy of where you have it at minus 20. A wet bulb of minus 20, the wet bulb at plus 80 has much, 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 much more energy than what you have. So this warming up in the northern climates is very, very inconsequential compared to what's going on in the oceans. So the ACE is the response to distortions of the temperatures because of the oceans, not because of the CO2. You see that point there, all right? Now, unfortunately, I don't have the time. I can't believe how fast time goes when you're having a good time, okay? As the globe starts cooling again, because it will cool where it warmed the most, the energy will again bundle more in the tropics. The ACE index should turn up as the globe cools. As the globe begins, because it's going to be cooling in the north, it'll lead to more activity in the tropics, all right? The East Coast is long overdue for multi-hit season as a cycle is much like the 1950s. Comments showed the absolute ignorance on Irene, which was not near 38, 44, the sisters of 1954, and of course Donna in 1960. Another comment by Miss Cullen that the earthquake in Irene showed that the Earth was pissed off at global warming was just astounding to me. And as the globe cools, the bovine baloney brigade, I don't swear, so that's what I had to say, will increase more. Now, so it's a simple test, which Bill Nye did not wish to acknowledge with me on O'Reilly. Why don't we just perform a test? Let's see where the temperatures go by 2030 according to objective satellite measurements. I say by 2030, we're back to 1978. So, Dennis, I'm not predicting the little ice age yet, all right, whoever you are, okay? And I think that, again, the thermostat idea, I'm trying to get that across. It's obviously the ocean and not the CO2. I have something called the triple crown of cooling, the oceans, the solar, and the wild card is volcanic activity. We know that volcanoes in the Arctic shoot up into the stratosphere, and that can enhance blocking. We know that in the tropical regions, they lead to a much quicker response. But there's also a counter response where an El Nino will develop a lot of times because of a tropical volcanoes. Now, the question to me is, how can any clear-thinking human being, in light of the fact, not at least admit there is enough doubt to allow the test to go forward instead of crashing our economy based on what may be a utopian ghost? Okay, now the ice, real quick, the ice. Let me just get this done here. Total global sea ice is near or above normal. Think globally. Think globally, right? We've got a southern ice cap, too. By the way, what about the good old, you know, it's May of 1987. How the heck did those submarines, that's May 18th, 1987. Now, how is it that someone tells me the Arctic ice cap is gone, and yet there's the picture of the Arctic on May 14th. You can't see any open water in the Arctic down there. That's all. That submarine is from 1958. It was also surfaced with a lack of water in there, or a lack of ice in there. My argument, they tell me now that this is this ice that we have, because the extent is back to normal, this is rotten ice. It's just like termites have different CO2. And speaking of ice, even though this has nothing to do with this, how come there's no hockey stick in China? I guess they don't play hockey over there. But the Chinese studies show no hockey stick. Now, again, I went over all this energy idea. that the fact is that warm, moist, saturated air has a heck of a lot more energy. And that means when you drop the tropical ocean temperatures, it has a big effect on the Earth's overall temperature. It takes a while. It's called a lag. Just like it takes a while for it to rise, it takes a while to fall. We have that when God created, I do believe that God created the planet. Okay, I'm sorry about that if that offends anybody. But unfortunately, and something I want to ask him is, why is 75% of the land in the northern hemisphere and 75% of the ocean in the southern hemisphere? Because that creates an imbalance. I know we all want Earth in balance. We want to all go to bed, have it rain for 3 hours, get up and it's sunny the next day with a high of 75 and a low of 55 every day. But that doesn't happen. So because of all this, we look to the ice. If there was truly global warming, why is the southern ice cap expanding? All right. And by that, I mean, there has to be some kind of compensating cooling. And all we're seeing right now is a distortion of the letter X back there, which means I'm done. All we're seeing now is a distortion of the temperature picture, where it's a bit warmer in the northern hemisphere. We're measuring it, but it is actually cooler in the southern hemisphere. These oceans have cooled enough to allow the ice to expand. And we're just going to switch it back the other way. So I guess I didn't time this the right way. It's funny, when I first saw the schedule, I said, I'm speaking for an hour and a half. I got to come up with some graphics over here. And then I realized it was down to 30 minutes. Unfortunately, I didn't look at it till like 3 days ago. But anyway, do I have, what's that? Q&A. I have to Q&A.
Come up in direct Q&A from what you
Yeah, go on. That's a track race.
We will have Q&A, and... Okay. Okay. One question from the internet.
Hello? Okay, great. Joe, this is from Jim from the United Kingdom. His question is, are winters going to be colder in the coming years for the United States and Western Europe?
I think the U.S. is going to have a cold winter this year, and I think overall, we're looking at a pattern that is basically in the 1950s heading for the 1960s. So if you give me the next 20 years, I'd say out of the next 20 years, 5 will be warmer than normal, 5 will be near normal, 10 will be below normal. That's in Western Europe. In the U.S., I think it's more of a 50-50 spread, but I'm anticipating a cold winter in the U.S. because we just had a double La Nina, and the El Nino coming on, I believe, is just a response to that. So what will happen is it'll be a Central Pacific El Nino and a weak one, and that is usually the kind of thing that delivers the goods into the U.S. That's what you saw in 2009, 2010.
Before we get to our next question, two notes. First of all, John Dunn, MD, sitting at the front table, says he is available after this talk to administer IVs to those who could not handle Joe Bastardi's talk. So thank you, Dr. Dunn. And second, when we get to questions, just please keep them to 30 seconds or less and in the form of a question.
What do you know about the drowning polar bears in the Arctic oceans?
I don't know much about polar bears. I have two guinea pigs. And I think that in nature, everything lives and then everything dies. And it sounds to me, from what I understand, that the polar bears are doing pretty good right now. So much so that I believe the Eskimo population wants to start hunting them again. But I always thought that that was sort of a side issue. And I always liked the commercials with the polar bears drinking Coca-Cola. I think that's just as... I just don't have much to say about polar bears. I do know that they're up in the Arctic and the penguins are at the South Pole.
I have a question here. You made a good point, a good case for global warming not having an impact on hurricanes of late. But looking at the future, do you expect there to be some or even just a little impact from global warming on hurricane activity?
I think that what happens is as you, and of course this is a very long-standing view that I've had, as you start cooling the northern climates again, it implies that there will be a reason to bring up the ACE index again globally. All right, you got to understand what I'm looking at. I try to stand back and sort of, what's the Occam's razor things and say, well, what is that trying to tell me, this big picture? Why, if the Earth is warmer, if the Earth is supposedly warmer, are we not seeing the evidence of all these tropical cyclones and hurricanes and all this other stuff going on. I believe that it's because the energy picture is distorted because of the warming that has occurred in the northern climates. Now, let me again remind you, if you ever drive around on a cold morning, you notice how your thermistor can bounce up and down in the car very quickly? It takes precious little energy to change the temperature where it's very, very cold. On a hot summer day, if you're looking for a high of 95 and it's 94, it's very tough to get the temperature to go one more degree. So what I'm saying here is hurricanes, in spite of how vicious they look, they're very delicate animals as far as the atmosphere goes. Okay, the first thing that's going to kill a Category 5 is the fact that it becomes a Category 5. Because as soon as it does, it's going to start to weaken because it takes perfection to develop that kind of storm. When you're looking at the distribution of energy in the tropics to the temperate regions, you want to bundle energy in the tropics in a certain area one time after another. If that process has already been accomplished, in other words, if the process is such that the energy is distorted, the pressures are lower across Canada than they're supposed to be, or than average, you generally will not see the amount of activity. It's not all, well, there's warm water. I mean, if it was just warm water, or if it's just the air temperature, how come we don't have hurricanes every single day? So I think there will be an increase as the global areas cool. And the problem is, when we have a cold PDO, warm AMO, they love to target the eastern seaboard of the United States. So I think that, and Lord help us if 38 comes along. They're going to be writing like it's the apocalypse because they're going to make sure that people don't understand that there was already a storm that bad. I mean, if you understand the history of hurricanes, you'll see that basically what we went through is almost underachieving compared to what happened in the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Okay, we have a question down here. Jim, you have one?
Yes, we have another question from the people watching the live stream on the internet. This is from Cliff in the United Kingdom.
Wow.
The La Nina phenomenon is said to suppress hurricane activity in the Atlantic due to less wind shear, but climate models suggest that hurricanes will become more frequent and stronger. Does this mean the ENSO patterns will become more extreme?
Wait a minute. La Nina suppresses hurricanes? Is that what he said?
The La Nina phenomenon is said to suppress hurricane activity in the Atlantic.
Well, that's not true. The La Nina actually, because of the cooling of the Pacific, there's usually less wind shear in the Atlantic. So the premise is, if he means El Nino, there is a correlation between the El Nino and less hurricane activity. And the reason that happens is when you warm the temperatures in the Pacific Ocean, you lower the pressures over the southwest part northwest part of South America, which increases the low-level easterlies, which establishes more of a deep trough in the Caribbean with a west-southwest flow along. I mean, you're asking a question that is basically you got 3, 4, 5 different parts to it. So I'm not. The first thing that threw me off was the La Nina. The U.S. biggest hurricane seasons are usually when there's a La Nina going. So I don't know. I don't know what his question really is. No, I don't. I anticipate an increase in hurricane activity over the next 10 to 15 years because we've been so low as far as the ACE index goes. And listen, they're going to name everything they get their hands on. So there's not much I could do about that.
You've referred to 1938 several times.
Wow.
Could you tell us more about that for those?
That hurricane, I'll tell you what, any of you folks ever get a chance to go to downtown Providence, Rhode Island, stand in front of the Biltmore Hotel and look up and see where that high water level was, and then go to understand what actually happened. A wind gust 186 miles an hour at the equivalent of a skyscraper, 683 feet, that's Blue Hill in Massachusetts, and you would understand that that probably is the greatest deviation from normal as far as a storm hitting the United States. To have a surge of water up Narragansett Bay that some people say was 50 feet. Now, out of the Hamptons, supposedly was 50 feet. I never get invited to any parties out there anyway. And I'll tell you what, they got a 5-foot dune out there. If 38 comes back, all those houses will be gone. But the 1938 hurricane, very interestingly, just like most of the East Coast years, you'll find that the average is only 10 or 11 for the big years that the East Coast gets hit. It's not like 15 or 20 in some of the big years that we've had before. The ACE index is usually slightly above normal. But 38 and 54 both stayed east of Hatteras. and ran up, 54 was Carroll, and Carroll almost pulled what 38 did. At 38, the 38 hurricane hit, and the amount of tree damage in New England, supposedly trees were falling at the rate of 1,000 trees a minute. 2 billion trees were supposedly knocked down. All the heavy rain was on the west side of the storm because the trough that's picking it up is cooling the atmosphere. So all that warm, moist air, there's condensation, and the wind was with the center and off to the eastern part of the storm. But, you know, I look at New Orleans under 10 feet of water, but, hey, you build a city 10 feet under sea level on a 90-degree Gulf of Mexico. Guess what? Providence, Rhode Island's at 42 degrees north. New Bedford's up there. And so the 38 hurricane in 54, they just stand out. 44 was unbelievable, too. I mean, 44 at Atlantic City to take out that boardwalk, when you've seen the history of all the storms that have come up through there, you had, again, 600-mile-wide diameter hurricane-force winds. The storm is passing east of Cape Henry, sustained 134, gust to 156 out of the north. I'm sitting there going, if that happened today, can you imagine what people would be saying? I mean, just think about that. If there's 15 feet of water up into Providence, Rhode Island, actually they have a dam there now, so it wouldn't go into Providence. It would just flood everybody in the you know, East Greenwich and all the towns down below in the bay would get it. But the 38 hurricane stands out to me as the greatest example of the power and majesty of the atmosphere, and we haven't seen anything like that. I realize Camille's a big storm and Andrew's a big storm, but at Providence, Rhode Island, to see that type of thing, that's about as extreme as you get. And it was during a warm cycle. Right, the 30s, 40s, 50s. My dad used to say, you can't imagine how bad the weather was when I was growing up. He used to always tell me that. You know, and I go back and look at it. Sometimes when you're a kid, you say, well, my dad said this or my dad said that. I go back and look at what was going on during that time. And I say, holy cow. And, you know, we had to fight a war. We were in a depression. Those people had a lot of guts. And the climate was very bad, too.
My understanding is the climate models require humidification of the mid-troposphere over the tropics.
Yeah.
What's your understanding of what's
That's part of the we're talking with the so-called greenhouse gases, okay? They are greenhouse gases, I guess we could call that. But it's water vapor. And it seems to me that water vapor is self-regulating in that when it starts cooling down, it starts raining more, all right? So a lot of times the idea is the more moist it gets in the tropics, the energy capacity of the air is greater, and that develops the trapping that they've been looking for. But there is no trapping. Part of my 400 millibar theory is this. If it's cold in March, and you got to understand, hurricanes need everything to go right to develop. I mean, people think, oh, look at this and look at that. As soon as that storm begins to pump that Q up into there, it's also trying to entrain dry air. So what will happen is, in this 400 millibar theory is, if I'm going to warm it at 400 millibar for the tropical season, chances are it's going to dry out. In fact, I posted on WeatherBell this morning showing how it is warmed over the tropics, but the air is bone dry now at 400 millibars all in that area. I like 400 millibars because it's a nice convenient level between 500 and the tropopause, which is way up high in the tropics. But yeah, the whole idea is that we're supposed to get warm and moist at that level, and that in turn traps it. And I don't see any evidence of it. Maybe someone else does. Questions?
You're amazing.
Amazing. Maybe I didn't get through with everything.
All right, well, thank you so much. We got one more. Go ahead, Mark.
Look, I'm going to be the first to admit, I believe in God above, all right? I believe, you ever see the movie Chariots of Fire, where Eric Little says, God made me fast and I feel his pleasure whenever. Well, God made the weather and I see evidence in him every day. And as I've gotten older, that's what happened. On a clear day, I'm looking at the sky going, I can't believe this. I mean, I'm like that. So I think it comes down, the last graphic said, it comes down to this, Ecclesiastes 1:9. There's nothing new under the sun. What has been before will be again. And I believe that. And I think what happens is, I'm not trying to get all, you know, preacher over here. I'm trying to say that we observe things now we had no capability of observing before. The other thing is, too, we're arrogant. We think, oh, I got an iPhone. I could get something in 2 minutes, right? The atmosphere is a wonderful, and for my purposes, an infinite system. Man, as a finite being, has a tough time handling the infinite. But man, because man wants to believe that he's in control of things, that he's not really, that's what starts happening. And I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, in a way, the whole environmental movement is sort of admirable in a way because it shows that people want to reach beyond themselves. They want to do something bigger than themselves, all right? But the question is, in trying to do something bigger than themselves, are they trying to enforce their will upon other people that in turn will limit what other people can do? You know, I've always been brought up to be an individual. Take care of yourself and you're able to help take care of people around you. So some of that comes from this, and I'll admit I'm biased toward that.
All right, well, thank you so much, Joe.
My pleasure. Thank you. Sorry I didn't get done.
Our next session will begin at 10 a.m. For those of you watching over the internet, that's 10 a.m. Central Time. And be there early because we will start sharply on.